Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have David Seeloff as our narrator for part two of The Secret of Ancient Religion. David?
Yes. Hi, Georgianne.
Hi.
Okay, I didn't... we're going to delve even deeper into the subject, showing the background and development of idolatry, which is the worship of man-made images.
Yes.
In addition to the worship and communication with so-called gods through those images. Now, it's important to keep in mind that idolaters, whether today or in the past, never believed that they were praying to or worshiping the idol or the image itself. They always and clearly understood that they were praying or worshiping through the God, or through to the God that was represented by the idol or the image. And you have the same thing today with images of Mary or the saints. They're not praying to the statue. They're praying to the to the person represented by the idol or the image.
Yes.
But that's what idolatry is. The Apostle Paul discussed the nature of idols and the reality of the gods behind them in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 to 6. Quote, "Now as touching things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but charity, or love, edifies. If any man think that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if a man love God, the same is known of him. As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things which are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is none other God but one. For though there be that are called gods," theos in Greek, "whether in heaven or in earth, as there be gods many and lords many, but unto us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we in him. Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge." Now, note the phrases about knowledge that begin and end this passage. What was known to all and what was known to a few, and understand the differences. And you might want to read that passage of 1 Corinthians 8, verses 1 to 6 in a more modern translation than the King James. "Everyone knew that idols were not the God itself. But for the pagans, the traditions were seen to have a certain power. Only a few knew that there was only one real God, the Father, and one Lord Jesus Christ. There are non-physical beings that do indeed exist that are called gods, in Greek, theos, and people made sacrifice to those beings, and they do so today also. Although the physical idols, thinking that the gods listen and respond only through the physical objects," that's what the people believe. "It was rote repetition to metal, rock, and wood. However, there were entities that existed that were real, and they were also called Elohim in Hebrew and Theos in Greek. And I ask this question: if such entities as gods, real gods with small g, did not really exist, if other entities and beings did not really exist, then what was the great problem and prohibition with idolatry? What difference does it make? You'd be praying to nothing. Consider this verse from Exodus where God speaks to Israel about the Canaanites. In Exodus 23, verses 32 to 33, "You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their Elohim," gods, plural, "and they shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. If you serve their Elohim," gods, plural, "it shall surely be a snare unto you," end quote. In other words, if the gods of the Canaanites did not really exist, if they were only the imaginative fantasies of the Canaanites, as so many theologians would have us believe, then why does God care? How could Israel serve a covenant with other gods unless there were real beings to covenant with? How could Israel serve other gods and be snared by them if they didn't really exist? In other words, if they did not exist, what was the big deal? The Elohim and the Theos that the idols represented were actual living non-physical beings. They did and do exist, and the Apostle Paul calls them demons. The word devils is used in the King James Version. In Greek, the most common term to refer to these beings is daimonion. The Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 19 to 21, "What say I then? That the idol is anything, or that which is offered in sacrifice to idols is anything? But I say that the things which Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils," daimonions, "and not to God. And I would not that you have fellowship with devils. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the table of devils." The term daimonion is the diminutive of another Greek term, daimon, which is used only a few times in the Greek New Testament. In the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, daimon is used disapprovingly of the gods of the nations. In non-biblical Greek, daimon and daimonion were considered beneficial teachers and instructors of secrets. The idiot's practice of idolatry and worshiping devils goes on today and will continue right to the time of the end. As it says in Revelation 9 and verse 20, "And the rest of men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not of their works, of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk," end quote. So let's, with that introduction, let's get into Dr. Martin's part two of The Secrets of Ancient Religion. And from here on in, these are Dr. Martin's words. "Most people today know very little about the origin of the world's religions. There has been a cloak of secrecy obscuring this subject over the centuries. Last time, in part one, the central teaching of ancient religions, the belief that most deities were once humans who lived on earth and were deified by the belief in the immortality of the soul, was revealed by biblical and historical proofs. In this part two, the matter is taken a step further by disclosing the source of pagan idolatry and the error of its teaching. The information in this part two could be an eye-opening revelation to those who wish to understand the Bible and its teachings. We begin this part with a statement that many people may find unbelievable, but it is nevertheless true. For the first 2,500 years of human history, there is not one record available, and certainly not in the Bible, which shows the use of idols in the form of stones, metals, woods, or any any other earthly substance as a means through which humans worshipped the true God in heaven, or even in the worship of false gods. And this fact can be abundantly proved by the Bible and the historical records that have come down to us from antiquity. This truth means that for well over a third of recorded human history, no one in civilized society thought it was proper to worship divine beings through images made of earthly materials. Such early people would have considered that procedure to be silly and absurd. When it finally occurred, as it assuredly did, it represented a major departure, actually a degeneracy, into a form of worship that the earliest people on earth would have found ridiculous and childish. Believe me, this includes such folk as would have been living in the areas of Babylon, Egypt, Greece, Rome, or Palestine. This may be difficult to believe, but it is a truth that can be absolutely proved from the biblical revelation if one is willing to pay attention to what it teaches. But people are more prone to conveniently overlook, either by accident or design, what the Bible actually says on these matters. And this is a sad state of affairs, because the Bible is so clear and understandable if people will just pay heed to what it says. What emerges is this: pagan idolatry, in which images made of stones, metals, woods, etc., were used, had its origin only about 3,500 to 3,600 years ago. It developed at a time when almost the entire world went into a wholesale idolatry. The series of historical events that brought about its evolution occurred within a 100 to 200 year period. The biblical record shows that hardly anyone in the civilized world used images through which to worship God. And then suddenly, the whole world seems to have gone over to the error of using material substances to worship God. It is time that the historical truth is made known to the general public. If people of the present and those who have lived since the introduction of images and idolatry could thoroughly understand how the pagan gods originated and how images and idolatry developed and how silly the whole thing is, people would have long ago been able to appreciate and comprehend the simple truths of God, which He revealed to mankind from the beginning. And strangely, these false teachings, which should have been jettisoned by thinking people years ago, have become firmly entrenched within the very fabric of modern Christianity itself. The Bible tells us that the move into idolatry was a deliberate attempt on the part of some intelligent people to corrupt the simple teachings of God. The Apostle Paul gives us some facts about the origins of idolatry, and he is very pointed in saying that the people who devised such erroneous beliefs were well aware of their falsehood. In Romans 1, verses 20 to 21, it says, "For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God." Then, earlier to verse 18 of Romans chapter 1, "These were they who hold back," and that's the original Greek, "who hold back the truth in unrighteousness." Paul goes on to say in verse 23 that mankind's determined will was to hold back the real truth and to change the glory of the incorruptible God into, quote, "corruptible man, birds, four-footed beasts, and creeping things." As I said, Romans 1, verse 23. There was a definite reason why paganism and idolatry were inaugurated. And though many false teachings began to emerge not long after the flood, the use of image or idolatry was something that came on the world scene at a particular time. And that period was just after the death of Joseph, who had ruled as second in command next to Pharaoh in Egypt. By the time of the Exodus from Egypt by the Israelites, idolatry was a prime religious factor in the worship of all deities. In this part two, we will show some of the reasons why image and idolatry came into use and the consequences of it. So it occurred at the time of just after Joseph. We previously gave two examples in a previous article of modern-day fairy tales. For example, in the article Modern Sex Signs in the Churches, which we haven't done a presentation on it because there's a lot of pictures in there, where it's shown a short explanation of the origin of some fairy tales and modern stories. When we say modern, we mean the myths that arose some 5 to 10 centuries ago, and not those engendered before the birth of Christ. So, let me get to... Now, two of them were... One was Jack and the Beanstalk and Cinderella. The Dark and Middle Ages in Europe were periods of time when many people could not read or write, and yet the people were normally dominated by a theocratic system of Christianity. Still, there was some knowledge of biblical characters and their exploits, and it was common for storytellers to frequent the fairs and the festivals. They told many types of stories. Such things were counterparts to our movies and television today. And some of the most famous were those that had their original themes centered on various personalities of the Bible. At first, the stories would be more or less the main teachings of the Bible, but as time went on and the tales got repeated, every storyteller added some of his own creativity to the plots in order to heighten the interest of the hearers. What resulted were some new and often contradictory stories that no longer resembled the original accounts in the Bible. And that even Sir Walter Scott said of himself that he could never repeat a story without giving it a new hat and a stick. Such things happen with all of us. It is the nature of us humans to supplement stories with ideas that originate with ourselves. In most cases, it is not an attempt to deliberately deceive. It occurs simply because we want to make the accounts more interesting. So let's go back to the text from the footnotes. My footnote back button isn't working here. This happened with the storytellers in the Middle Ages. Jack and the Beanstalk was a mixed-up hodgepodge of the biblical story about Jacob and the ladder, which he saw at Bethel, about 10 miles north of Jerusalem. The folk tale of Cinderella was a corrupted account of Ruth the Moabitess, who married Boaz, the grandfather of King David. The basic story of Cinderella has shown this to be true. What is significant, however, is the fact that most of the stories about the gods and goddesses of ancient paganism arose in a similar manner. Almost all of them, of which we are familiar from ancient Greek literature, had their beginnings at a time when the art of writing was practically extinct in the Greek areas of the world. The 200-year period of the Judges, both in Palestine and other areas of the world, was a time of great decline in literary and academic endeavor in the world. It was the first dark ages, the first dark age since the flood of Noah. It was in this period that most of the mixed-up stories about the gods and goddesses of the Greeks, Phoenicians, and other Mediterranean peoples came into existence. The works of Homer are the first examples of Greek literature to come down to us practically in its entirety. The time of Homer's life has been disputed, but without doubt we can know that he flourished during or before the 8th century BC. By the time Homer wrote his accounts of the early Greek gods and goddesses, which the Greeks worshipped, had become elaborate and complicated, often contradictory stories. These early tales reflected an outgrowth of the legends that originated in times of illiteracy among the early inhabitants of Greece and others who bordered the Mediterranean Sea. Just as today, with our modern myths of Cinderella and Jack and the Beanstalk, so it was when Homer began to compose his romances about the Trojan War and the wanderings of Odysseus. And though his accounts could have been basically true, the matters of the gods and the goddesses who preceded the period were accounts generated in times of illiteracy. When Greek literature came of age in the 6th and 5th centuries BC, most of the intelligent peoples were already admitting that the stories of the myths of the early gods and goddesses were fabulous elaborations, and they were. But what must be recognized is the fact that there were often some truths, much corrupted, that inspired the tale, the creation of the tales in the first place. So who were the early gods? One of the earliest Greek writings was a composition written by a Phoenician named Sankoniathon. That's how I'm going to pronounce it anyway.
Okay.
His work preceded that of Homer, but how long, no one knows. In it, Sankoniathon describes the origin of the major gods and goddesses, and that many of them were once humans who lived on the earth and were later, after their deaths, deified and sent into the starry heavens. Sankoniathon, his main interest was in the early Phoenician deities. His account is important to biblical students because the Phoenicians lived next door to the Israelites of Palestine. And what is interesting, he records events about the pagan gods which occurred in the biblical areas. And he mentions deities that the later Greeks and Romans adopted into their own pantheons. Remarkably, some of those early pagan gods and goddesses are none other than people of the Bible that God dealt with in a personal way in the patriarchal period. Take, for example, the ancient pagan god Cronus. This early Phoenician author, Sankoniathon, states that Cronus went about the world establishing settlements and colonies. He gave the best parts of Greece to his daughter, Athena. But he did much more than that. Sankoniathon said, quote, Cronus offered up his own son as a sacrifice and circumcised himself and forced his allies to do the same. End quote. This account is so reminiscent of the chief events in the life of Abraham that there can be little doubt that the pagan Cronus was none other than a mixed-up version of Abraham, the father of the faithful. And recall, Abraham sent the 12 children of Ishmael, his other son, into the areas south and east of Palestine, and his 6 sons of Keturah into the east country to settle and colonize those areas. according to Genesis 25, verses 1 to 18. The Phoenicians knew that Cronos did the same thing, but they had some of his descendants going into the Greek areas. Now, it was common knowledge in the time of Christ that the people of Sparta on the mainland of Greece were descendants of Abraham. They were not Israelites, but they were descendants of Abraham. This is mentioned in 1 Maccabees 12, verses 1 to 23, and by the Jewish historian Josephus in Antiquities, book 12, section 4, I'm sorry, book 12, chapter 4, sections 10 to 11. I need to redo those, the numbering of Josephus. So, continuing on with who were the early gods. The offspring of Cronus went to Crete, and from there to Troy, some of them, and all over Greece. Many of these stories are vague, they're often mixed up tales, but remnants of truths can be seen here and there within them. And we need to be beware of these stories, for in no way can they be used as primary source material of true history. But for interesting accounts on how many biblical characters became gods and goddesses of later fame, you should look at Robert Graves' well-known book, The White Goddess. And we give evidence of this elsewhere in this article. Going back here. Oops. Going back quite a bit. Now, it may be astonishing to realize, but the historical Zeus, one of the major gods of the Greeks and the Romans, was none other than a literal descendant of Abraham, who went to Crete and established a kingdom for himself there. The fact is, God told Abraham that he was to become a father of many nations, not only of the Jews and the Israelites, and that many famous kings of the world would issue from him, according to Genesis 17, verses 4 to 6. It can be shown from history that some of the later Parthian kings, who were the chief adversaries of the Roman Empire in the time of Christ, were descendants of Abraham. Moses of Koren, in his History of Armenia, a translation and commentary by Robert Thompson, published by Cambridge, by Harvard University Press, 1978, page 83, says this to be, you know, quotes Koren as saying that. Indeed, even the Austrian Chronicle, which has a confused history of peoples who lived in the Danube Valley region, says that an Abraham had a prime influence in the early colonization of that area. It was common for pagans to call Abraham by various names, but the Phoenician name was Cronus, the god who controlled time. As for Cronus, he was often confused with other historical beings, but his Abrahamic connection is clear. Sankonathion gives further evidence to substantiate this. Quote, for Cronus, whom the Phoenicians call Il, the word Il is phonetically the Semitic god, or El, sometimes it's translated bull, whom the Phoenicians call Il, a man who after his death was deified and instated in the planet which now bears his name. Now, all the quotes of Sankonathion are cited in by Eusebius in his preparation of the Gospel. And Eusebius said that the book Sankonathion was called the Theology of the Phoenicians, which unfortunately has not come come down to us today. Back to it here. Okay. The particular planet that the Phoenicians called Cronus was the one the Romans referred to as Saturn. It is well known that the day of Saturn was Saturn Day, Saturday, the weekly Sabbath of the Jews. Now, note this. Sanconiathon went on in his description of Cronus by saying that one of his sons was called Eod, clearly a corrupt takeoff on the Israelitish tribe of Judah. There can be little doubt that Cronus, the god of time, was basically the biblical Abraham, with elements of Shem thrown in. And since Abraham was given promises by God to last throughout time, throughout the aeons, he was designated as the one who best governed time. What the heathen did was to elaborate the account of Abraham from the biblical history by adding new and erroneous information. In most of the later pagan myths, one could hardly find the actual Abraham in the tales of Cronus as shown by the Greeks, the Phoenicians, and the Romans. Just as today, it is difficult for us to find Ruth and Boaz in the story of Cinderella, but there is little doubt that the original Cinderella was the biblical Ruth. Abraham is not the only biblical person found in the early mythical stories of the Phoenicians and the Greeks. The patriarchs Jacob and his brother Esau are prominently featured. Sanconiathon said that a man by the name of Hypsiranias, the name meaning high heaven, took up an abode in the city of Tyre. Quote, and he fell into enmity with his brother Eusios, who first made clothing for the body of the skins of the wild animals he could catch, end quote. It's plain that this Eusios of the Phoenicians is the biblical Esau, the brother of Jacob. Note that the Bible says that Esau was a hairy man, a man who was hairy, like that of an animal, and that Jacob received the blessings and birthright of Esau by deceiving his father and putting on an animal skin, according to Genesis chapter 27. Even the prestigious religion Dictionary of Religion and Ethics, volume 11, page 179, states that there's no question that this Eusios within the Phoenician pantheon was the biblical Esau. Sanconiathon says that the god Eusis, or Esau, was the one who taught the Phoenicians the art of shipbuilding and navigation. The other name for Esau was Edom, meaning red. The Greek name for Edom was Erythras, Erythras, and it was recognized in ancient times that King Erythras was one who made sailing vessels. Now, and this is mentioned in Strabo, his geography, book 16, chapter 3, section 5, and book 16, chapter 4, of section 2. Yeah, back to where I was.
I have hard copies of Strabo's.
Oh. You got me there. That I don't. are they rotting away in your floorboards?
Oh, or yes.
Now, it's plain. It's plain that this Eusios. Okay. The Red Sea near Egypt, and also the arm of the Indian Ocean called the Persian Gulf, both were named after this King Erythras, or Edom. Eusios was the one who inspired the Phoenicians on the Mediterranean Sea to do the same. Really, both were the same man, And Jewish beliefs also taught that Esau helped to colonize Tyre, the city of Tyre. In other words, he helped found it. And that his descendants became some of the Phoenicians who settled North Africa and Spain. And this is according to the comment by the medieval Jewish scholar called Rashi, who on the biblical text of Genesis 25, verse 23, since Esau married in with the Canaanites, according to Genesis 26, verse 34 and 36, verse 2, it's conceivable that this belief of Rashi is indeed correct. So, as a matter of interest, the Jews in the time of Christ and later said that the aristocratic Romans who came to Italy from the ruins of the Trojan War were Edomites from Esau. There may be some truth to this. One of the principal tribes that helped defend Troy, the supposed homeland of the original Romans, was the Paeonis tribe, who came from the Strymon River region of Macedonia, according to the Iliad, chapter 2, section 99. Herodotus called these people the Syro-Paeonis in his history, chapter 5 and section 15. And Plutarch, in De Fluvius, in chapter 11, said the Strymon River was Pestinian. This seems to show that people from Palestine, Syria to the Greeks, were in Macedonia. Another name for these people was the Odomantoi, or the Edomites, perhaps. Amazingly, Aristophanes, the Greek playwright, in his work, the Acharnians, in section 157, said these people practiced circumcision. And an early commentator to Aristophanes said that they thought themselves to be kin to the Jews. And this is in Edwin Guest's Origin of the Celts, Volume 1, London, 1883, page 223. Let's see here. Whatever the case, it's clear that people from Palestine colonized a lot of the western and northern areas of the Mediterranean basin. And that the early traditions attest that Esau, or Edom, was among the ones who went in that direction. For certain, we can know that Usios, or Esau, was one of the prime gods of the ancient Phoenicians. It must be realized, this fact must be realized, that many of the pagan deities were actually people in the early biblical period who often had special spiritual experiences in their lives that had profound effects upon society at the time. These individuals were finally deified after their deaths. Later people added many fallacious accounts to the history of their lives, so that if Abraham, Jacob, Esau, Joseph, Samson, Ruth, and Boaz, etc., could come back to life and witness what later interpreters said they did in the pagan descriptions, they would be astonished and no doubt disappointed. Now let's look at the rise of idolatry. As stated at the beginning, there is no evidence that images of stone, metal, and wood, etc., or pictures were used in an idolatrous way about the first 2,500 years of recorded history. But the Bible shows that after the time of Joseph's death, such things were utterly prohibited and outlawed. At least they were for the Israelites from the time of the Exodus onward. No longer could normal images and pictures be used in worship. But in the patriarchal period, from Joseph on back to Adam. Such things, even representatives of divine beings, were not looked on as evil. Rachel, the wife of Jacob, stole the images of her father and took them with her to Palestine, according to Genesis 31, verses 19 to 35. These were in the form of divine beings, as it says in verses 30 and 32. And those divine images could have been of the sons of God, or the cherubim, or seraphim, or even other angelic beings. Have to remember that those before the flood knew what the cherubim looked like. They saw them. They were standing in front of Eden, in front of the garden, keeping away people who would try to break in with a sword. Here we are. The fact is, those images were not being used for idolatrous purposes. At no time does it say that Rachel or Jacob worshipped the images or worshipped God through the use of the images. What these represented were title deeds, as verses 43 through 45 of Genesis 31 show.
What is a title deed?
Well, the title deeds of ownership were in the shape of images to denote the covenant with God, the Elohim, that the holder had for the use of certain lands.
Oh.
And these images were no more, like the contract, or the seal on the contract.
Oh.
It shows ownership, and that's why Laban was so upset. Because it showed those images that Rachel took, he stole his title deeds to the land that he was living amongst the other tribes that weren't believers like Laban believed. So, you know, produce your evidence that you own this land.
Yes.
And then you would put other images around the area of your land, the boundaries, and that your image would look like other people's, be different from other people's images. So these were also boundary markers. That's what she took. Why she took them, I have no idea. I don't quite understand it, and there might be terms in the text of Genesis 31 that we don't fully understand. But those images, as I said, were no more being worshipped than any other stick or stone found along the way. In Genesis 21, verse 33, it says that Abraham planted a grove, a tree in Beersheba, as a memorial for God's blessing. And there was not the slightest condemnation from God for him doing so. However, from the time of Moses onward, such a thing was prohibited for the Israelites to do, although it was common for later people to wrongly use such trees for idolatrous purposes, as it says in 2 Kings 21, verse 3. Abraham and Jacob thought it perfectly proper to construct altars anywhere they saw fit. But after the time of Moses, it was forbidden to make such altars. This is said in Deuteronomy 12, verses 13 to 14. Jacob set up a pillar to remind him of a sacred event that occurred in his life and the location of that event. But this was later proscribed by Moses in Deuteronomy 16, verse 22, in the margin, in most modern translations. And now for a surprising fact. It could be said that the erection of that pillar by Jacob at Bethel was the prime event that brought the idolatrous use of images into vogue. It was not that Jacob himself was an idolater, but what he did at Bethel was so famous among later peoples, heathens, heathens as well as Israelites, that the event sparked the use of stones as a means of worshiping God, or the worshiping of pillars and images themselves. And let's see how this happened. The patriarch Jacob was famous in the ancient world, and the reason for this is plain. He was the father of Joseph, who had been raised to second in command of all Egypt. This was at a time when the civilized world came to Egypt to get food for their survival. This is in Genesis 41, verses 56 to 57. Joseph became a man held in the highest esteem by all peoples of the Middle East. Obviously, his father Jacob was also held in similar respect, since Joseph profoundly honored him. The religious experiences of Jacob must have affected Joseph and all Egypt very much, and later history shows that they did. The fame of Jacob and other patriarchs spread throughout the known world at that time. Let us now return to the records of the Phoenician called Sankothion, and he mentions that one of the major gods of the Phoenicians was called Uranus. This deity was the first who constructed stones that were looked on later as having life in themselves. In other words, he was the one who originated an idolatry based on pillars or stones. And here is how Sankothion, this is how he put it. Moreover, the god Uranus devised Betulia, and these are the contriving stones that move as having life. The word Betulia is a clear reference to Bethel, the place where Jacob first raised up a memorial pillar stone. Really, the god Uranus and teachings about him are a corruption of Jacob and some events associated with his life. The word Uranus means heaven and is part of the name Hypsuranus, which means high heaven. And he had a brother by the name Useus, Esau. And though the early Phoenician stories are much confused, as are all fairy tales and myths that arose in times of illiteracy, Uranus, heaven, is a Phoenician reference to Jacob. He was called heaven by the pagans because he was the first man in history to see the gate of heaven, Genesis 28, verse 17. It was Jacob who dreamed and beheld a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. This is Genesis 28, verse 11. Jacob was terrified by what he saw. In Genesis 28, 17, he says, "And he was afraid. And how dreadful is this place? This is none other than the house of God," which is the meaning of Bethel. "And this is the gate of heaven." Now, what did Jacob do as a result of seeing heaven opened and the entrance to the heavenly abode of God displayed in front of him? He decided to set up the stone pillar on which he had laid his head, which was probably, in this case, a rectangular stone that was once part of a building from the ruined city of Luz, L-U-Z, the site where he had been sleeping. Genesis 28, verses 18 and 19, it says, "And Jacob rose up in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up as a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at the first." This event, believe it or not, was the excuse for later pagans to commence their use of stone pillars in the form of images and even like buildings like the Washington Monument, pillars like the Washington Monument, made after the same design of the ones in Egypt. Same thing. That's a now would be considered a pagan thing. It is not that Jacob himself began this nonsense, but this occasion was reckoned by later peoples as so profound in the history of religion that they imagined that the heavens themselves opened their doors and the gods descended down the ladder directly into the stone itself. This made the pillar a live or spirit-filled stone. The heathen began to call this pillar stone, and all such stones like it, Bethel stones, or in the Greek language, Betulia, or Betulis. There came to be thousands of these Bethel stones raised up in various parts of the world. Note what the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, has to say under the title Betulis. Betulis in Greek, and this is the article Betulis, 11th edition, Encyclopedia Britannica, volume 3, pages 191 and 192, quote, Betulis, Greek, a word of Semitic origin that means Bethel, and denoting a sacred stone, which was supposed to be endowed with life. These fetish objects of worship were meteoric stones, which were dedicated to the gods or preserved as symbols of the gods themselves. See Pliny, Natural History, Book 17, Chapter 9. And Photius, I believe COD period, which means Codex 242. In Greek mythology, the term especially applied to the stone supposed to have been swallowed by Cronus. This stone was carefully preserved at Delphi, anointed with oil, every day. Exactly what Jacob did to the first Bethel stone, by the way. And on festal occasions, covered with raw wool, according to Pausanias, Book 10, Chapter 24. This is means to put on rough wool or a wool garment, like Esau, who was covered with hair, and like Jacob, who mimicked his brother Esau. It supposedly represented the prophetic office, according to Zechariah, as exampled in Zechariah 13 and verse 4. In the Phoenician mythology, one of the sons of Uranus, who was Jacob, who supposedly initiated the use of Bethel stones. One of the sons of Uranus is named Betulis. Another famous stone was the effigy of Rhea Cybele, the holy stone of Pessenis, black and of irregular form, which was brought to Rome in 204 BC and placed in the mouth of the statue of the goddess. In some cases, an attempt was made to give a more regular form to the original shapeless stone. Thus, Apollo Aegeus was represented by a conical pillar with pointed end. Zeus Melchilius in the form of a pyramid. Other famous Betulic end idols were those in the temples of Zeus, Telios, at Tegea. Even in the declining years of paganism, these idols still retain their significance as shown by the attacks upon them by the ecclesiastical writers, meaning the early church fathers. End quote. The truth is, there came to be thousands of these Bethel stones scattered around the world. There were many of them in Ireland and Scotland. In fact, some people claim the rectangular stone, which is under the throne of England, is the actual stone that Jacob anointed back at Bethel. What nonsense. That type of red sandstone is not found anywhere near Bethel in Palestine, but it is found in abundance near Duff Stavanag in western Scotland. Dr. Martin lived in England for about 12 years. And just because the stone very early had the name Bethel associated with it, the Stone of Scone, it is no proof whatever that it was Jacob's actual pillow stone, which he set up as a pillar. This is especially so because there were thousands of such Bethel stones in various temples and shrines of the pagans. It may be surprising, but the first use of tombstones by the early heathen was a takeoff on these Bethel stones. In the Dictionary of Religion and Ethics by Hastings, in Volume 1, page 143, it says, "There is reason to think that Bethel's originated upright tombstones, which from being at first divine or ghostly dwelling places, became merely commemorative in a late age." The stones in front of sacred shrines, let me start the sentence over again. The stones in front of sacred shrines, such as obelisks, or even special pillars in temples or homes, if used for divine purposes, were also types of these Bethel stones. And for more information on pagan syncretistic doctrines, which usually had sexual overtones, by the way, reflected in the symbolism of Christian architecture, we have on the ASK website an excellent article by Dr. Martin called "The Anatomy of Church," and let me get back here. Okay, here we go. The setting up of the pillar stone by Jacob was not of itself idolatrous. Even the manufacture of images of heavenly creatures, humans or animals on this earth, was not wrong in the patriarchal period. Many believers of Islam, not originally, but later on, came to believe it was idolatrous to represent any animal, or human beings, at all. Although originally it was not the case. Egypt and Babylon were filled with such representations from a very early date. But after the death of Joseph in Egypt, the whole scenario changed. People then began to believe that the images and pictures of divine beings took on the characteristics of the deities themselves. This is when idolatry began. By the time of Moses, the practice was rampant. And this includes also the belief that access to the deity was made easier by direct appeals of the prayers and prostrations to the god through the image or the idol. Still later, the images themselves were believed to contain some aspect of the god's power. However, no pagan in the past or today ever believed that the image or idol itself was the god, but that it merely represented the god. So the next section deals with the importance of the Book of Job. And I think we should break here. This one split into two, Georgianne.
Okay.
Otherwise, it would be pretty long.
Okay. You've been listening to David Seeloff. Please visit their website. It is askelm.com. You can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And as we've said in part one, Mr. Seeloff is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And so ends part two of The Secret of Ancient Religion. God bless everyone that's listening. Good night.